This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 20 years ago, writer Tim O'Brien released a book of stories about young men and war, his war, Vietnam. Among many other things, he listed the weight of each soldier's clothes, canteens, and can openers. From the book, every third or fourth man carried a Claymore anti-personnel mine, 3.5 pounds with its firing device. They all carried fragmentation grenades, 14 ounces each. They all carried at least one M18 colored smoke grenade, 24 ounces. Some carried CS or tear gas grenades. Some carried white phosphorus grenades. They carried all they could bear, and then some, including a silent awe for the terrible power of the things they carried. And that's also the title of that book of stories. The Things They Carried is now a staple of college and high school English classes, celebrated as one of the most important books about the experience of war. The author joins us in just a moment. Today we want to hear from veterans. What did you carry? What do you still carry? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, the great play-by-play man John Miller on the art of play-by-play. But first, novelist and National Book Award winner Tim O'Brien joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And parts of that book were framed from a distance of 20 years. It's now another 20 years since you wrote the book. What do you still carry?
Well, I carry the memories or the ghosts of a place called Vietnam, the people of Vietnam, my fellow soldiers. More importantly, I guess I carry the weight of responsibility and a sense of abiding guilt. I carry joyful memories, too, friends I made and the conversations at foxholes where for a moment or two the war would seem to vanish into camaraderie and friendship. The wars don't end when you sign peace treaties or when the years go by. They will echo on until I'm gone and all the widows and orphans are gone.
In some ways, you write how the experience of being close to death so often made things extremely vivid. Do those remain the most vivid memories of your life?
Very much so. I just finished talking with a group of high school students here in D.C., and the conversation eventually got to just that question. That there's something about being amid the chaos and the horror of a war that makes you appreciate all you don't have and all you may lose forever, which goes from the sublime, your parents, down to the petty, the Big Mac and a cold Coke when you really, really are thirsty and you're drinking patty water. The mind will lock in a can of cold Coke the way your mind might, you know, back in high school, locked in a pretty girl.
Does it surprise you that all these years later, your book is taught in high schools around the country?
Yes. I had written the book for adults. I had imagined an audience of literate people on subways and going to work and in their homes reading the book, but I certainly hadn't imagined 14-year-old kids and 18-year-olds and those even in their early 20s reading the book and bringing such fervor to it, which comes from their own lives, really. The book is taken, supplied to a bad childhood or a broken home, and these are the things they're carrying. And in a way, it's extremely flattering, and other times it can be depressing. I had a kid come up to me not long ago and through a book signing line and say, "Yours is the only book I've ever finished." And of course, it was meant in a flattering way, and I took it that way. But in the back of my mind, I thought, God, all the pleasure in it that this kid has denied himself.
Yeah, but he's got all those great books in front of him.
That's the thing. It opens a door to some of these kids is the wrong word. It sounds sort of derogatory. These human beings were young. The door has been closed to them through their own doing or that of their parents or their schools. Who knows why? And if a book can open that gateway or that doorway and encourage someone to find the pleasures of reading, what a great thing to have accomplished in your life.
Here's one of those literate people with writing with an email, Shannon in Lyndhurst, Ohio. I'm a professor, and I've been teaching your novel for 6 years now and consistently fall in love with it every time I read it. What I would like to know is, what is the single most important message you would like your readers to take away from the novel? P.S. My students love to hate Azar. I say that is because you are Azar.
Well said. Oh, goodness, to take one thing away, it's a little bit like having a piece of cloth and you unravel a strand and the cloth dissolves as you look at the strand. The goal, I suppose, that any fiction writer has, no matter what your subject, is to hit the human heart and the tear ducts and the nape of the neck and to make a person feel something of what the characters are going through and to experience the moral paradoxes and struggles of being human. And in a way, for me, although on the surface, of course, it is a book about war, I've never thought of it really that way in my heart. Even when I was writing it, it seemed to be a book about storytelling and the burdens we all accumulate through our lives, our moms and dads and backyards, teachers, my dad died, 4 years ago. And he is as gone as anybody I knew in Vietnam. But like the ghosts of Vietnam, all I need to do is, close my eyes a moment, and there he's throwing me a baseball. And there's something about carrying the image of and the symbol, the emblem of carrying, that, at least in my experience, is pretty important to being human, I mean.
Yeah, we're talking about the things they carried, and we're asking veterans to call us today to tell us about the things they carried and the things they continue to carry. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Jeff. Jeff calling us from Des Moines.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is telling your screener. I'm an Iraq war veteran. I was there in 2005, 2006, and there's never really thought about it. But there's three things I carry with me every day. I still wear my dog tags every day. I'm retired now. And I've got a P-38 can opener.
Those things work better than most everything.
They do.
And when I was in Iraq, my driver made wristbands out of 550 cord for everybody in the section. And I wear that every day.
What's 550 cord?
550 cord's a nylon cord that, if you've ever been in the infantry, it's got a million and one uses. Probably some I haven't learned yet, but pretty much every infantry unit I was ever in.
The ones you don't know about are probably the ones in the manual.
Yeah, probably. But I wear a suit and tie every day, and a lot of people comment that that's a little jarring to see a piece of green nylon braided into a wristband on my wrist, but I wear it every day, so just to remember that time. So.
And what do you take away, Jeff?
I think it's because I was in the military for so long. Hope nobody takes offense to this, but that's a completely different world than the civilian world, and it reminds me of all of my experiences in the past and a lot of good memories. So, I don't know. It's habit now, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You don't still have your P-38, do you, Tim?
I wish I did. You're right. That thing worked, and most of the can openers I use these days break in 3 minutes.
Yeah, they do. Terry's on the line. Terry with us from Gainesville.
Hi.
Go ahead, Terry.
I still got my P-38.
Oh, well. Maybe you can make those for the civilian market.
Actually, you can get them still through Ranger Joe's at Fort Benning.
All right.
But I also carry shrapnel in my leg, a bitterness.
Where'd you collect the shrapnel, Terry?
I spent my first 9 months as a rifleman, then a squad leader, west of Chulai, and 198th Light Infantry. And last 3 months, I managed to get a job as a door gunner, on an observation ship, and I got hit carrying a Marine Artillery Observer out of Da Nang. I'd like to say that one of the things that I still carry is the wonder that people voted to keep us there. I came back and joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and I found that you couldn't tell anybody what you had witnessed without having some experience. It just, they either didn't want to hear it or they couldn't relate to it. But the people that sent us there and kept us there, Count Johnson and Nixon and Kissinger and the rest of them, they knew that we weren't there to do anything but have a geopolitical influence on the Russians. Unfortunately, I didn't do a research project on why we were in Vietnam until after I got back. Yeah. And the reasons were not what they told us.
It's interesting.
I got nobody to blame but myself, but I felt very foolish for having trusted the government with my life.
Terry, it's interesting what you say about stories. A lot of Tim O'Brien's book is about war stories and how if they sound believable, they're almost certainly not.
Yeah, I identify with virtually everything that our caller just talked about. I, too, was in the 198th Light Infantry Brigade and near True Lie.
Working. All right, way to go, 198th.
Yes. The our AO was, an area of operations was near where the My Lai massacre occurred in Quang Nai province. And my memories are much like yours, and I think I carry with me the same thing you're carrying.
Terry, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. It's 20 years since The Things They Carried hit the store shelves. We'll talk more with author Tim O'Brien in just a moment. We also want to hear from veterans today. What did you carry? What do you still carry? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More than 2 million copies of The Things They Carried have sold since 1990. It's been read and passed around by countless veterans from Vietnam to the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tim O'Brien's book has also been optioned for a film, but so far it's not made it to the big screen. Now, to mark the 20th anniversary, a new hardcover edition is out to read a selection about the acidic boredom of war. You can go to our website at npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Tim O'Brien is with us here in Studio 38. We'll want to hear from veterans today. What did you carry? What do you still carry? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go next to Rich, and Rich is with us from Sunman in Indiana.
Yes, sir. I actually carry two things personally. I do have a P-38, and I also have what Air Force crew chiefs called a church key, which was your normal, everyday metal can opener. I was a crew chief on 141s and KC-135s during the very end of the Vietnam War, stationed with the 619th Mass at Hickam Air Force Base. And during the first Gulf War, I was stationed with the 512th Aircraft Generation Squadron out of Dover Air Force Base. But the things that I don't personally carry, but I used to carry every day, were the coffins coming back from Vietnam, the nuclear warheads coming back out of, I guess I can say it today, were Subic Bay, because we used to catch them at Barbers Point Naval Air Station outside of Hickam Air Force Base, and the nights that I spent at Dover during the first Gulf War with 145 to 150,000 pounds of JP-4 on a C-5 and 30 to 40,000 pounds of small arms and rocket ammunitions and or motors, and you would see the lightning. And then all of a sudden,
oh boy, JP-4 is jet fuel, by the way.
You can't refuel anymore, you know?
Yeah. Oh, boy. It's hard to believe, isn't it, Rich? I was just talking with Tim O'Brien just before we were on, started on the show, that it was 20 years after his tour that he wrote this book. It's 20 years since then, but it's almost 20 years since the first Gulf War.
The first Gulf War. It's almost hard to believe. I mean, I went in as a kid. I entered the Air Force in 1973, my senior year of high school, and then I went back, joined the reserves, and was in the reserves for about 18 months, got called up, I believe it was in September of 1989, to go active duty during the first Gulf War, and I was still a staff sergeant because I'd been out for that long, and I was the old man, and it was hard to believe that the things that we put on the shoulders of the young people in the military, because I had been out long enough to say, I'd worked now for Procter & Gamble for a while, you know, and things were important, but they weren't like it was when, you know, you go out there and you're sitting on that bird and there's lightning and stuff around you. You just, back then, you didn't think about it.
Yeah.
But then that was when I was 17, 18, 19, 20. Now you get up to 35 and you think, man, you know,
yeah,
I could be gone in a split second.
That's...
And we did lose a bird at Dover, got hit with lightning, and it tore the wing off between number two and number three engine.
Wow.
You know?
That is the reminder that is consistent in your book, not just the what you then considered an old man looking back.
Yeah.
You're a much older man now. But the incredible youth of, well, you and the others in Alpha Company.
Yeah, at the time, it seemed I was among people who were fairly mature. But looking back on it, these were 19, 20, 21-year-olds. People who at the time looked ancient to me turned out to be 27 or 28. I think it's an important reminder for all of us that those who are due to our killing and our dying are not kids exactly, but they're not certainly not mature adults who have been schooled by life and what life can deliver to us. And that is a lesson probably worth tucking away.
Email from Charles in Portland, Oregon. I wasn't old enough to serve during the Vietnam War. My stepbrother was. I made a nice knife sheath for him out of leather that held his fixed blade knife, and it had another compartment for a pair of needle nose pliers that he found useful for a variety of purposes. I could imagine how that could be useful. Let's see if we can go next to this is Daniel. Daniel Withers from Greenville in Tennessee.
Yes, sir. I was in 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines in Somalia, and at the time I was a 19-year-old kid. And I picked up there and have carried sense and empathy for other people's suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And now I currently work in the mental health field. And I want to thank Mr. O'Brien because when I was in college, his book was one of the books that we studied.
That was after your tour in Somalia, I understand.
Yes, sir. And it was kind of cathartic for me, actually.
I'm delighted to hear that. I was talking with Neil before the show started and saying that books can sometimes have impacts on human lives that go way beyond what an author intends as the book is being written. And you can help people in ways you would never expect. And I'm delighted to hear it. May have helped
Thank
you a little.
Very much, sir.
And Daniel, the things you still carry, I wonder, every day you hear about another ship being taken by pirates off the coast of Somalia, or about the gun battles erupting between the government that holds three square blocks of downtown Mogadishu and the warlords. What do you think?
Actually, you know, at the time I was too young to truly understand, but I think we as a nation and as military service did a major disservice to the Somali people. We left them in a vacuum that, you know, we were there to kind of take that vacuum away, but we left it almost in a worse condition than it was.
Daniel, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Let's go next. This is Chris. Chris calling us from Fort Myers, Florida.
Yes, hi. Hi, Mr. O'Brien. It's an extreme pleasure to speak with you today. I actually was first introduced to the things I carried in DeWitt Henry's class at Emerson.
Uh-huh.
And I always have three copies of your book, one that I keep completely clean, one that I use for notes as an English teacher, and one that I kind of use for notes as a writer and a learner. And I think you're crucial to me having been now a published author myself, if only for the reason that I wear my Red Sox hat with all my book covers because, well, Tim O'Brien does it, so I can do it too.
We like you anyway, Chris.
Of all the amazing things you've given me, probably the most crucial to my development as a person is you gave an arena for my father and I to talk. And I think I'm 35, and I think a lot of my generation, Vietnam is a lost topic for us because our fathers don't want to talk about what happened to them. The memories are too close and too horrific. And through the things they carried, my dad and I were actually able to have conversations about his time in Vietnam, which ultimately led to me, and he's very sick right now, actually, but it led to us being able to have conversations about each other. And so it really became this place where him and I could go to, and we couldn't talk about anything. We'd talk about your work and use that as a vehicle to discuss war and what he had experienced, but also who he was as a person.
That's a great thing to hear. The you know, the rewards of being a writer can include, you know, awards and money and that sort of thing, but a story like yours is the one that makes me remember being 24-year-old and setting out on a career to be a writer. I hear from disparate sources stories kind of like yours. I had a letter from a young woman, 26-year-old woman in Minneapolis, a story kind of like yours. My dad was quiet, and there was trouble in the family, and my mom was trying to explain to me why she had never been able to fall in love with my father, who had been in Vietnam, at least not wholly in love. And in AP English class, she encountered the book, gave it to her dad. He began talking, and the mother began talking. They went to counseling, and they're still together. They're not perfect, but they're happy. And a thing like that makes me want to cry, because that is nudging up against my intent in writing this book. Not to heal that family in particular, but to have a book transcend bombs and bullets and in some way or another worm its way into the human spirit and heart. So thanks.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Chris, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to, this is Brian. Brian calling us from Birmingham, Alabama.
Hey, how are you guys doing this afternoon?
Not too bad.
Hey, I just want to thank you for your book because, I went through a couple of combat situations and I didn't know, I was one of the, these kids that are coming back now and kids that came back from Vietnam. I was one of those kids and I didn't know how to talk it out. I didn't know how to get help, stuff like that. And I thought I was in my world all by myself, in this pretty much world of hell, in my brain. I read your book. I read Chicken Soup for the Veteran Soul, little things like that. Yeah, I went in with an open mind, but yeah, I kind of figured, okay, this is just another pile of garbage to just throw onto the stack, and of self-help books. But it opened my eyes to make me realize that there are other guys out there like me. And it made me want to, go counseling. I signed up for my VA medical benefits, stuff like that, and it really helped me. And I just really want to say thank you because, it's funny because my wife, she's a couple years younger than me, but, I'm from the Northeast. She's from Alabama, but she never had anything to do with the military. Mm-hmm. She had a father that was early 80s, no combat or anything. So she really didn't know how to ask me questions. And it's been, because of your book and other books like that, and the counseling, it's actually made me be able to explain to her the stuff that I went through and, be able just to talk about it instead of just keeping it in, let it become like a little bomb.
Yeah. Brian, those of us on the radio side here, thank you for your judicious use of the word garbage.
Well, yeah, that's no problem. I have some family that works for the NPR up in Boston area, so I understand.
Been trained.
You've been used, so.
Thanks very much, yeah. Brian.
And I also have a P-38 also.
Really?
And I actually use it today as a screwdriver. So I just wanted to say, yeah, I got another vet with one. Thanks again, guys.
Bye-bye. Here's an email that we have, this from Matt in Palmyra, Virginia. Tim, I've read your books in reverse order. Just finished your memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone. The thing I carry in is a father-in-law who was a captain and reminds me of the hard-edged, anti-hippie, hard-drinking captain who took you out that night to set mines. He doesn't talk about the experience at all. How do I approach the subject, or should I leave his memories to himself?
Probably a little of both. I think in the end that there are all kinds of reasons for silence. It can go anywhere from trauma to simple politeness. War is a party pooper of a topic. You don't go to a cocktail party and say, hey, you want to hear about Nam or Iraq? Out of politeness, one stays silent sometimes, at least in my own case, because I have no idea where to start, where to end, what to choose to talk about. It's overwhelming, and therefore you go quiet out of a kind of nervous, the daunting task ahead of where do you begin and where do you end. So to encourage through books or movies is a starting place. And if a person wants to talk, that person will talk. I certainly don't think that enforced conversation is going to help anyone. But to open the door to conversation through art, it's not a terrible idea.
We're talking with Tim O'Brien. His book, The Things They Carried, came out 20 years ago. I think it was 20 years ago yesterday.
Yes, it was.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's interesting you're talking about art. Do you watch movies about war? Do you watch?
When they're good, or if I'm told they're good, I will. I saw a great film called The Messenger. Have you seen this movie yet? But man, I thought it was not in a war, but knocking on doors. I mean, I really was touched by it, and I thought it was beautifully acted and had me in tears. Others bore me.
Did you see The Hurt Locker?
I haven't seen it yet, no. Yeah. Is it good?
Yeah, it's good. It's interesting. I wonder also the TV series, The Pacific. Have you been watching that?
No, I've been on the road, so I think didn't it just come out?
Yeah, it just started a couple of weeks ago.
No, I haven't seen it.
It's interesting. You should give it. It's challenging in a sense. I've studied that particular battle. They're in Guadalcanal at the moment, and I've been there, and it helps to have been there and seen these sites.
I'll bet.
But on the other hand, it so accurately transmits the absolute sense of confusion and chaos. I'm amazed they took such risks with the lack of, coherent narrative.
That's good. I'm glad to hear they're doing it that way. I mean, that's my recollection of war, is chaos and where am I and why am I here and where are they? Utter lost feeling, almost like being trapped in a bad dream.
Let's see if we get another caller in on this conversation. Let's go to Ed. Ed's with us from Traverse City in Michigan.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Sorry I did not read your book. That'll be the first thing on my agenda.
8 million and one.
Well, I had served many years ago and in many different fashions, but the thing I would like to most share about war today is how sterilized it is on television and how people can see it and go, wow, that looks bad. And then turn away, and then turn on another channel, and not really look in the eye of the other soldier who is fighting and dying just for what they believe in as well. And I have, unfortunately, have had that.
And where was that, Ed?
In Panama in 89 for Just Cause. And I was also activated in support of Somalia, which was another... interesting deal to watch a 10-year-old kid hold an AK-47 that was darn near as tall as he is. I mean, it was just unreal. But getting back to the Panama thing, taking someone's life, looking in their eye up close and personal, knowing that it's just someone else. They might have kids. There's somebody's brother, somebody's son, father. That's what war is all about. And I think Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are geniuses, and I think that they have captured what it's really about. I mean, I know nothing about World War II, but I don't know. I give it to World War II veterans that I was even able to serve.
Ed, I hope you tell that kid we hear in the background, You tell that kid your stories.
That's my youngest, and he's keeping me running, but I try not to tell it because I still haven't. Because when I got out of Panama, PFTD was non-existent. My way of dealing with that was selling off every gun I owned in my house because I got tired of waking up in the middle of the night and shooting howler monkeys and snakes and spiders and PDF, Panamanian Defense Force guys. I got holes in my wall, so that's how I dealt with that.
Ed, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. And Tim O'Brien, thank you so much for sharing your time today.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
20 years after the things they carried. Coming up, John Miller joins us as baseball season gets set to get underway. This is NPR News.